Okay, Boker Tov, everybody. Welcome to, as we move to our Nach portion of Tanakh, Torah Nevi'im Uktuvim. It's a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Tzvi Grummet, who, even though he wrote the book, the Maggid book on Bereshit, the first book in Torah, we're asking him to the first book in Nevi'im, in Sefer Yoshua. And Rabbi Grummet grew up in the United States, taught for 18 years in America before making Aliyah. He teaches at Eretz Tzvi and many other places, the education, director of education at the Lichtenstein Center for Jewish Education. And he's a wonderful teacher, an insightful teacher, and it's a pleasure to welcome him aboard. And I want to thank you. The shiur this morning is being sponsored by the Chanelis family in memory of Suri Chanelis, Surah Bat Abraham Yehoshua Heschel HaKohen Vifrimit, and in honor of her grandchildren, Ashi, Nava, Tova, Akiva, Ramit, Tzachi, and Daphna. May her neshama have an aliyah. Thank you very much, everybody. Rav Tzvi, it's all yours.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. And just looking through the names and the faces, I recognize some people from a previous year that I gave, and I recognize some faces from various points in my travels over the years, and welcome to all of you. It's great to see you virtually and to be here with you and to be able to learn together with you. Sefer Yoshua is an extraordinary sefer. I love most of the Sfarim in Tanakh, but Sefer Yoshua holds a particular place in my heart. And I'm going to share my screen. You're not going to see my face for most of this, except maybe in a little box in a corner. But that way we can all share in the sources that we have together. This is my sources, my outline, and afterwards, all the slides will be available through the Torah in Motion website. So I tried to identify within Sefer Yoshua, there are many, many things happening in Sefer Yoshua, but in trying to identify two core themes, and each one of them has many branches. And I call it a book of transitions and completions. All right, and we're going to go through each of these separately, they sort of complement each other because it's all about going. I'd like to jump right into to the Sefer, and by the way, also to give a shout out to Rabbi Kelman and Torah in Motion and what he has created over the course of the last I don't know how many years, but really poured his life and his lifeblood into this. The fact that there are hundreds of people wanting to join these shiurim from all across the world really is extraordinary. Okay, so let's jump right into Sefer Yoshua and begin to explore what I mean over here by a book of transitions. Okay, let's start with the transition from Moshe. Okay, when you open up to the beginning of Sefer Yoshua, one of the things that is so striking is you open up to the first parak and you expect to hear something about Yoshua. And in the first parak, what you hear more than anything else is the name of Moshe. And you see it up here on the screen. I took two selections, one from the beginning of the parak, one from the end of the parak. Moshe's name appears in between these two selections as well. But you look at the opening, Vayiachrei mot Moshe, Eved Hashem, when Moshe, who's Eved Hashem, dies, then Hashem speaks to Yoshua ben Nun, who is Misharet Moshe. He was Moshe's assistant, right? So Pasuk Aleph, right, he's talking to us about Yoshua, introducing Yoshua, and the only person that really counts over here is Moshe. You go in a little bit further on, Hashem says, I actually missed one. Here's another one at the beginning of Pasuk Beit. Moshe Avdi Meit. All right. Moshe is dead. Time for you to take them into the land. All right. Kasher Dibarti of the end of Pasuk Gimel El Moshe. So in the first three Psukim, Moshe's name appears four times. Yoshua's name appears once. And this sort of begs the question, which is a huge question, of how do we make the transition from Moshe to Yoshua? Think of it in these terms. For most of the people who are alive that Yoshua is with, they've only known one leader in their lifetime. Moshe led them for 40 years. The only people who know something else, right, were the people who were alive before they left Mitzrayim, which is very few. People above the age of 40. They know only one leader. Reminds me a little bit of, I remember years ago when I was in the Soviet Union, and I was talking to somebody there, one of the older people, and he mentioned to me that, you know, when Stalin died, we thought the sun was going to stop rising. He was everything. He was the beginning. He was the end. He was the mother. He was the father. He was everything. Moshe provided everything for Am Yisrael. He was everything. And the question that has to be on their minds is, how can we continue without Moshe? Moshe was the one they turned to when they needed water, when they needed food, when there was a problem with Hashem. Moshe gave them the guidance, the direction. He did everything. And so Acharei Mot Moshe, one of the great questions is, how do we, as a people, as individuals, as a nation, how do we move forward? Right? How do we get past the fact that the one leader that we had, upon whom you were completely dependent, is now gone? And that is, I think, one of the really big questions that hangs over this book. And there's a corollary question to that. Over the course of this shiur, we're going to actually deal with both of those. We're going to touch upon them a number of times. The corollary to that is, how can anybody step into Moshe's shoes? Right? Moshe is just this larger-than-life figure. How can anybody fill those shoes? Right? And that's a very big question. I'm sure it's a question that the people themselves asked. I'm sure it's a question that Yeshua asked himself as well. He more than anybody else, knows Moshe's greatness, and he has to be asking himself that question, which then highlights even more so when you open up the beginning of Sefer Yehoshua, and you find Moshe's name as the most prominent thing in the opening three psukim. That has to highlight for us, the readers, the same thing that was highlighting for Yehoshua and for everybody else. The other example that we have of this, again, in which it really screams, is at the end of the perek. The end of the perek, Yehoshua turns to Reuven and Gad and half of Shevet Menashe, who, as we all know from this week's parsha, Parshat Matot, Perek Lamed Beit of Sefer B'Midbar Sinai, they ended up, I'm not going to go into the whole story, they ended up with an agreement that they were going to settle on the eastern banks of the Jordan River, right? Not on the western banks. But the price that they were going to pay for that is they were going to demonstrate beyond the shadow of a doubt their loyalty to the rest of Am Yisrael. They were going to fight. They were going to lead the battle in the conquest of Eretz Yisrael. So here, what Yehoshua does is he turns to Reuven and Gad. This is in the second selection over here. Yehoshua turns to Reuven and Gad and half of Menashe and tells them, look, you know, you have an obligation and fulfill your obligation. So when he speaks to them, right? So Pasuk Yud Beit, Yud Gimel, Yud Dalet, Tet Vav, right? So he himself mentions Moshe's name. He keeps invoking Moshe's name. You made a deal with Moshe. You have an obligation to Moshe. Again, it like rides over everything. And then when you take a look at their response, right? Their response in the last two psukim, right? And it's specifically in the last pasuk, in Pasuk Yud Zayin, they say, "Kechol asher tshamanu el Moshe," just like we listened to Moshe, that's how we'll listen to you, which means that Yehoshua's authority is dependent on his relationship to Moshe, right? In terms of the people and how they view Yehoshua. But now they add what is, it could be one of the most frightening things that Yehoshua hears from anybody. Rak, in the second half of this pasuk, Rak provided that, Yeh Hashem Elokecha imach ka'asher haya im Moshe, that Hashem is with you the same way that Hashem was with Moshe. Between you and me, that's a very high bar. How anybody can meet that bar, that Hashem will be with them like Hashem was with Moshe, is almost begging Yehoshua to fail. So Perek Aleph really presents to us the looming figure whose shadow is cast over this entire Sefer, right? is the figure of Moshe, and that's one of the most important pieces in the transitioning away from Moshe, and that's right front and center. This transition shows itself in a number of other places, or the need for this transition shows itself in a number of other places, where Hashem comes to demonstrate in very clear ways exactly what Reuven and Gad said. It's almost as if Hashem is trying to calm Yahushua, but also trying to reassure the people. So there are a number of things that happen in the first few prakim of the Sefer, specifically in Perek Gimel and Dalet, in which Hashem sets up Yahushua as clearly the heir to Moshe's legacy. The first one of those comes to the crossing of the Jordan. Okay, now the crossing of the Jordan is an interesting story. It's a little bit different than the splitting of the Red Sea. It's a river, so all you have to do is stop the waters that are upstream. They flow down, and what's left is dry land. And Hashem does that. The obvious question is, that was completely unnecessary. This miracle did not have to happen. People have been crossing the Jordan for thousands of years. Abraham crossed the Jordan on his way into Eretz Yisrael. God didn't stop up the river for him. Yaakov crossed the Jordan when he went out of Eretz Yisrael on his way to Haran, and when he came back. People have been crossing the Jordan back and forth. You go through Nach, you find lots and lots of stories. Gideon crosses the Jordan with lots and lots of people. The Midianim crossed the Jordan. So there are ways to cross the Jordan without miracles, and not just for individuals, even for large groups of people. The Midianim are 100,000 people, right? With flocks, with sheep, with, right? There are ways of crossing the Jordan. You don't need, it's not one of these mighty rivers. It's not the Mississippi, and it's not the Hudson River. It's the Jordan River. You know, it's our own version here in this little country we have of a river. So if you could cross it without a miracle, so why would Hashem make a miracle? Hashem doesn't stop make miracles in order to show how strong he is. But if you take a look in Perek Gimel of Sefer Yehoshua, which introduces this whole business, Hashem says exactly why he's going to do this, right? And that's the source you have here at the top of the page. Vayomer Hashem al Yehoshua, Hayom hazeh, today, he says, Achel gadelcha be'enei kol Yisrael, I am going to raise your status in the eyes of Yisrael, asher yedu'um, so that everybody will know, ki kasher hayiti im Moshe ehya imach, that just like I was with Moshe, I am with you. Now this is exactly, it's almost word for word, what Reuven and Gad said, and Hashem understands that, and he understands that Reuven and Gad may have been the mouthpieces for this idea, but there are lots of people who are probably thinking the same thing. So Hashem says, I'm going to make sure that nobody questions you. So just like the water split for Moshe, I'm going to block up the waters for you too. It was completely unnecessary in terms of crossing the Jordan for tactical reasons, but it was completely necessary in order to be able to uphold or to establish Yahushua's standing amongst the people. And you have the same thing in the next perek. Here's where Hashem introduces it. The next perek, we have the same idea, and particularly when you go to the last pasuk in this in this section over here, Bayom Hahu, this perek Dalet, this the very next perek Dalet pasuk Yudalet, Bayom Hahu, on that day Gidal Hashem et Yehoshua be'enei kol Yisrael. On that day Hashem raised Yehoshua's status in the eyes of everybody. Vayiru oto, people saw him. This vayiru doesn't mean to fear. It means to see. People saw him, kasher yaru et Moshe kol yemei chayav. Okay, all of his life. So exactly what the concern of Perek Aleph was, even before they enter Eretz Yisrael, as they are entering Eretz Yisrael, Hashem makes sure that issue is going to be addressed. Okay, so here's the first transition, the transition away from Moshe. And again, this is the beginning of addressing the question of, can Yeshua ever step into Moshe's shoes? What I'd like to do very, very briefly, just take a look quickly at the end of the Sefer. Okay? One reference from Perek Hey at the end of the Sefer, and then the beginning of Sefer Shoftim. In Perek Hey, there's a scene in which Yeshua meets an angel, which reminds us a lot of Moshe's introduction to God, right? It's just that this is not Yeshua's introduction to Hashem. It's Yeshua's inauguration into his role, just like Moshe had inauguration at the Sneh into his role. And what Hashem said, what this malach that Yeshua sees, the malach tells him in the language over here, for those who are attuned to this, the language over here is almost identical to the language that Hashem uses with Moshe at the Sneh. I highlighted here in red, Shal, in the first source, Shal na'alcha me'al raglecha, take your shoes from your feet. Ki ha'makom asher ata omed alav kodeshu, that the place that you're standing is holy, right? Which is exactly the same thing that Hashem said to Moshe at the Sneh, which that was Moshe's inauguration into his role. This is Yeshua's inauguration into his role. Maybe a little bit later on, we'll speak something more about the differences between them. If you go to the second source, here we see something interesting. The second source and the third source, and they really do a beautiful job of rounding out the picture. You go to the very, very end of Sefer Yoshua, but literally the very end of Sefer Yoshua. This is maybe four or five psukim before the close of the Sefer. Vayihi acharei hadvarim ha'ela, this is the second source over here. Vayihi acharei hadvarim ha'ela, vayamot Yoshua bin Nun, Eved Hashem. Yoshua bin Nun, who is the Eved Hashem, dies. Now, the significance of this shouldn't go unnoticed. If you remember, when Yoshua is first introduced, so I'll just jump back to that slide for 1 minute, right? Take a look at the very top line. Vayihi acharei mot Moshe, Eved Hashem. So the opening line of Sefer Yoshua identifies Moshe as the Eved Hashem. What does the closing line of Sefer Yoshua do? It says, not just was Moshe Eved Hashem, but Yoshua was successful in his attaining that same status, or that same that same descriptor as Eved Hashem, so that Yoshua really did step into the shoes that Moshe left behind, not in the same way that Moshe did, but Yoshua was successful. And the other piece that sort of rounds out the picture takes us to the opening pasuk of Sefer Shoftim. Sefer Shoftim opens with almost the same words that Sefer Yoshua opens with. Okay, let me just jump back again to the beginning of Sefer Yoshua, this top line. Vayihi acharei mot Moshe. It was after Moshe died. And that's the opening of Sefer Yoshua. How did Sefer Shoftim open? Vayihi acharei mot Yoshua. The same exact framing, right? But what we're doing is we're now switching from Moshe to Yoshua. Yoshua successfully completed that cycle, and Bnei Yisrael did make that transition. So not just Yoshua personally, but also Bnei Yisrael under Yehoshua's leadership managed to make the transition. So that was the big question that was sort of posed in Perek Aleph. The rest of Sefer Yoshua tells us that effectively Yoshua was successful in making that transition. Doesn't tell us how he made the transition. That we're going to see as we get towards the end towards the end of today's shiur. Okay, so that's the first. I said transitions. This is the first of the transitions, and much of the Sefer, particularly the beginning and the end, is devoted to demonstrating how Yoshua really takes over for Moshe. One of the fascinating things is if you take a look at the very end of the Sefer, and I did not prepare this in a slide, but this is something that one could do with a tremendous amount of work. If you take a look at I believe it's Perek Chaf Gimel. Perek Chaf Gimel is one of Yoshua's two speeches. These are the only real speeches he gives in the Sefer. So Perek Chaf Gimel is the first of those two speeches. If you take a look at almost every word that Yoshua says, every phrase is lifted straight from Sefer Devarim. Sefer Devarim is Moshe's words, and what Yoshua does is he takes pieces of Moshe's words, puts them together in interesting ways, and builds his own speech. So here's Yoshua completing the transition from Moshe.
Okay, Rabbi, I'm sorry to interrupt again. Now I'm back. Okay, thank God we seem to fix the problem. If you could just make your screen a little bit bigger, I think you go to settings, like widen when you show it. It's a little bit small, the letters. There you go. Thank you very much. Okay,
so better
again. Yeah, much better. Okay. Thank you. Nice to see everybody. I apologize for that. I have no idea why that happened. As you know, we have more room for 100. Anyways, we're all on. Back to the shir. Thank you.
Okay. So that's the first transition. The second transition takes us, and there are entire books that have been written about this. But the second transition really takes us away from a life of miracles into a life that looks much more natural. And this appears throughout the Sefer in a number of different ways. Let's start with food. Okay. If you want to talk about Bnei Yisrael when they were in the desert, their water was miraculous water. Their food was miraculous food. Man descended from heaven every day. They got their portion. They didn't have to do anything except go out and collect it, and then they could do with it whatever they wanted. They could bake it. They could boil it. They could crush it. They could do all sorts of stuff, but the food was presented to them. One of the first things that happens in Sefer Yoshua after Bnei Yisrael enter the land, they enter at the beginning of the month of Nisan. Right? They have Pesach literally 2 weeks later. Okay? One of the first things that Torah describes to us is immediately after they do the Pesach, okay, this is in Perek Hei, so this is early on, this is before any battles, before anything else happens, they eat the produce of the land. Eating the produce of the land sounds like a small thing, but the Sefer goes out of its way to highlight that. That was important. And it puts it into a context. And let's just read these psukim together, three short psukim. Vaya pasuk yud, all right? It's in Perek Hei, pasuk yud. Vaya chanu b'nei Yisrael ba-Gilgal. They camped in Gilgal. That was their home base for the first half of the Sefer. So they did the Pesach in its right time. Next, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Right, so you would think that doing the Pesach would be a big deal, right? Apparently, it's just as big a deal, because there's one Pasuk for that one and one Pasuk for the next one. They ate from the produce of the land. Mimachorat haPesach, the day after the Pesach, exactly what the Torah says. You're not allowed to eat the new produce until the day after you do the Pesach. Matzot v'kalui be'etzem hayom hazeh. So they ate matzot and roasted, but they ate the produce of the land, which means that they're eating natural food. They're eating the natural food of Eretz Yisrael, but they're eating human food. They're not eating divine food. They're eating normal food. They're not eating superhuman food. Okay? And the final pasuk over here really drew a debate. Vayishbot haman mimachorat bi'ochlam mi'avur ha'aretz. The man ceased falling the day after they ate from the produce of the land. Meaning the produce of the man was this miraculous thing that was meant to carry them through the period in the wilderness, whether that was going to be an 11-day period or a 3-month period or a 40-year period, the man kept them through a supernatural existence. But the minute they start living a natural existence, the man stops. Okay? And then the end of that pasuk, v'lo haya od ivnei Yisrael man, they had no more man, v'yochlu mituvuat eretz Kanaan b'shana hahi. That year already they started eating from the fruit of the land. So this is the first piece that we see in terms of the transition away from miracles. But there are other pieces that are very much related to this. And that has to do with what is probably the bulk of the Sefer. Basically, from Perek Vav all the way through Perek Chaf Beit is the story of the conquest and the settling of the land. That is the bulk of Sefer Yoshua. And in all of that, there's a tremendous move that we begin to see transitioning the people away from miracles. I want to just highlight something, in terms of the military, the military tactics, and we're going to take a look at a number of different military tactics that Yoshua uses. Now, the significance of those military tactics is, I think, can't be overemphasized, because if you look back at the original plan, Hashem's plan for Bnei Yisrael, and you hear this in Shirat Hayam, was that Bnei Yisrael were going to come out of Mitzrayim, they were going to march to Eretz Yisrael, everybody in Eretz Yisrael would be terrified of them and run away. That was the plan. Shamu amim yirgazun, chil achaz yoshevei palashet. Oh my goodness, all the nations, they heard about Kriyat Yamsuf, they heard about Yitziat Mitzrayim, and they're gripped by fear. Right, the Plishtim, the Knaanim, everybody. Az nifhalu alufei Edom. The alufim, the leaders of Edom, were shaking. Elei Moav yochazimu raad. The mighty ones from Moav are trembling. Namogu kol yoshvei Kanaan. All the people in Kanaan are melting. Tipol alehem emata b'fachad b'gdol zorecha yitbu ka'aven. Let your fear and your terror grip them. Ad ya'avor amcha Hashem, ad ya'avor amzu kanita, until your people manage to successfully go into the land and plant themselves in the land to be emo v'tita emo b'har nachlatcha, right? That was the plan. The plan was that the original plan was the entry into Eretz Yisrael was going to be completely supernatural. That plan didn't happen. And again, later on, we're going to talk about why it didn't happen and how that's relevant to Sefer Yoshua. But that plan didn't happen. Instead, what happens is that Yoshua manages to conquer the land, and in the process, Hashem helps him. It's sort of like power steering on a car, right? You have to turn the wheel, but there's somebody else who's helping things to move along. So Hashem certainly helps Yoshua. He helps Am Yisrael in the conquest of the land, but part of that helping comes through military tactics. Okay, it's not all miraculous, and there's a very, I would say, slow shift, but actually it happens fairly quickly, the shift away from miraculous existence. I want to start with sort of an overview. After the conquest, and we'll come back to the conquest of Jericho and the Ai and Givon in just a minute, but after the conquest of Jericho, the Ai, and Givon, we hear the following. This is the beginning of Perek Tet, okay? These two psukim, I've never seen anybody deal with this in a really serious way, but there's something really strange here. There's these two psukim in the beginning of Perek Tet that are up on your screen now. Vayehi cheshmoa kol ha-malachim asher be'eber ha-yardein. When all the kings who are on the western side of the Jordan, meaning the side of Eretz Canaan, whether in the mountains or in the valley or in the coastal region or in the north, right? Whether the Chiti, Amori, Kanani, Prizi, Chivi, and Yavusi, whichever nation it was, wherever they happened to be settled, they could be mountain people, they could be valley people, they could be coastal people, it doesn't make a difference. They all heard about what Yoshua had accomplished. Vayit kapitzu yachtav. So they joined together, they joined forces together to form a national coalition. Lilachem im Yehoshua v'im Yisrael pe'echad. There was going to be a Canaanite coalition like there had never been beforehand. 28 nations planned to band together to fight against Yehoshua. That never happened. These two psukim, it says they plan to do it. And then the Navi goes to talk about the story of Giv'on. And this national Canaanite coalition never came together. And the question is, why not? So what I'd like to do is I'd like to show you graphically of what's going on over here. And that's going to tie in to the conquest of Jericho and the Ai and Giv'on. We have a map here, and I hope you can see this. I hope it's large enough for you to actually see. I'll try to use my mouse to highlight certain things to make it a little bit easier. Let's see if I can do this. Okay, well, I'll try. The red lines over here, okay, these are Jericho, the Ai, and Giv'on. Okay, these are the first three cities that Yoshua conquers. If you can see a green line that I'm tracing over here, the green line actually is the basic path that Yoshua takes with Am Yisrael in their battles. Okay, now I'm right now looking primarily at the red lines. They go from the eastern side of the Jordan, where there's a little red dot, and the first place they go is Jericho, and then they move towards the Ai, and from the Ai they go towards Giv'on. You can see the movement over here is from east to west. They're going literally in a straight line. After Yoshua conquers Jericho and the Ai, that's when those two psukim that we just saw a minute ago, that's when it happens. Literally after the conquest of the Ai, so everybody from the north, way beyond the top of this map, all the way down to the south, way beyond the bottom of this map, going all the way down to Be'er Sheva, they all decided to band together. Then the story of Giv'on happens. For those who don't remember, the story of Giv'on, you'll see it's right here. Giv'on, the people of the Giv'onim, basically were involved in a deception. They tricked Yoshua, and they surrendered to him. So Yoshua conquers the city of Giv'on without firing a single bullet, okay? Which brings him one step closer in his march from east to west. What happens? What happens is that as Yoshua marches from east to west, he essentially cuts the country in half. Controlling Giv'on actually controls one of the major north-south roads that goes in the country. Today, that road in Israel is called Route 60. It goes all the way from Shechem in the north, which is right around here, right next to Tirza, and goes all the way down to Be'er Sheva. Okay, you can follow it. Those of you who are familiar, if you go to Gush Etzion, which is a little bit south of the map we have here, there are actually sections of that ancient road that still exist that you can walk on. The Romans paved that road. There are Roman milestones along there. So you have this north-south road. The conquest of Giv'on basically meant that traffic between the north and the south on the main road was frozen. So you no longer have a national coalition of 28. Instead, what you have is a southern coalition and a northern coalition, and they fight Yoshua independently. And that, so that if Perek Tet is the surrender of Giv'on, Perek Yud is the battle of the southern coalition, and Perek Yud Aleph is the battle of the northern coalition. The national coalition is destroyed because Yoshua has effectively cut the country in half. Okay? This is an extraordinary military tactic. Right? This isn't what we heard described in Uz Yashir of marching in and everybody runs away. They plan to have an organized battle. But Yoshua figures out a way to take the country and split it in half, and in doing so, using military tactics to divide and conquer and make the conquest easier. I want to take a look at this from a different perspective as well. Okay? We go to the next slide. This is a cross section of the Promised Land. Okay, there are two parts to it. One is literally a cross section, and the other one is sort of a geographical, a topographical map. And you'll see, as we all know, the Dead Sea, over here where it says Rift Valley, Salt Sea, okay, that's the lowest place on Earth. And from there, you climb up very steeply, and you get to your first plateau. Then you go up a little bit further, and you get to your second plateau. And then you go up a little bit further, and you get to a place called the Hill Country of Judah. Okay, and that is the highest point in the land. Okay, where it says the Hill Country of Judah, that is the line that that goes from there, from Yerushalayim, north all the way to Shechem, and south all the way down to Be'er Sheva. That is I forget what they call it in English, the dividing line. All the rain that falls to the east of there goes down into the Dead Sea. Anything that falls to the west of there is a continental divide. To the west of there, that goes into the Mediterranean Sea. It is the high point. The high point is incredibly strategic. When you're fighting a battle and you're going uphill, then you literally and figuratively, you have so much working against you. But when you're on the top, you can control everything. You can see. You have literally super vision over what's going on around you. So if we take a look at this, they cross the Jordan at the level of the Dead Sea, maybe slightly higher than that level, but not much. And they conquer Jericho, which is right around that plateau. Then they go to the next level. They climb up, and the city they get to next, where it says Wilderness of Judah, which is that middle plateau, which is sort of halfway up the hills. That's where the Ai was. Then, after the conquest of the Ai, which is its own story, then we have the surrender of Gibeon. Gibeon, which is just northwest of Yerushalayim, Gibeon is literally at the crest. It controls, by the way, not only the north-south road, which again I mentioned today, Route 60, which goes through Gush Etzion and past Beit El and all the way up to Shechem, but it also sits on the main east-west road. Okay, the main east-west road, which was the original way. This was the original road of getting to and from getting across the country. Today, Israel has paved a new highway there. It's called 443. It's the highway that goes past Modi'in. The highway that most of us are familiar with, going from, let's say, Tel Aviv towards Yerushalayim, route number one, that is a very, very difficult road. That was a secondary road. It twists and turns through the hills in very difficult ways. But route 443, which was the major road, that was an east-west road. Gibeon sits at the juncture of the north-south road of Route 60 and the east-west road of Route 443. It was incredibly strategic. So it means Yehoshua has effectively cut the country in half, divided that coalition, and now can go and deal with each of those individually. Okay? Let's continue with this, with the military tactics, because they are so central to the Sefer. But again, they're central to the Sefer in a way that highlights the movement away from relying on God to do miracles and B'nai Yisrael doing their part. Okay? And we're gonna come to... let's start with the bottom bullet over here. The bottom bullet over here, Yehoshua Perek Vav, this is the conquest of Jericho. This was battle number one. Okay? The description over here is fairly simple. We all know this. You march around the city for seven times and, once a day for 7 days. And then on the seventh day, you march around seven times and the walls come tumbling down. That's the story that we love. It's the Bible story they make movies about and we see pictures of it. And right? What happens after the walls fall? The city of Jericho does not surrender. There's a battle that takes place. Hand-to-hand combat, right? So Pasuk Beit, Gimel, Dalet over here describe the marching around the city and the walls falling down. But the walls falling down is only the enabler of the battle. What Hashem has effectively taught them to do is, how do you, or in this case, what he's done for them, how do you get past fortifications? But once you get past fortifications, you have to fight the war, right? If you take a look at the last four words in this passage, this whole passage over here describes the marching and the falling of the walls. But the last four words, after the walls fall down, V'alu ha'am ish nigdo. That's when the people have to rise up and fight against their enemies. There is a battle that's going to take place over here. The falling of the walls of Jericho was not the end of the Battle of Jericho. It enabled the Battle of Jericho. But the Battle of Jericho involved Bnei Yisrael going out there and fighting and doing whatever they needed to do in order to capture the city. So all Hashem did was, right, there was the miracle there that helped them get past the big obstacle, the wall. You have a similar thing, and I'm going to go back up now to the top of this slide. You have a similar thing happening with the Battle of the Ai. They come to the Ai, which is their second battle, and it's a city surrounded by walls. And in fact, since Hashem has withdrawn his protection from them, they don't know that, but he's withdrawn his protection from them, they attack the city head on, and there is no way that they're not going to walk away with wounds. There's no way they're not going to walk away with lots of casualties. They go to attack the Ai, and instead of conquering the city, they end up running away in defeat. Right? How is the Battle of the Ai eventually fought? Hashem taught Yehoshua a new strategy, a new tactic. What do? You take a group of people, and you make them the ones that everybody thinks are attacking the city. But your main army, you hide behind the city. And what happens is you have this group of people that are going to attack, and the people in the city are going to fight back, right? Because they're just like they did the other time, and they're going to chase the army away. And as the army is being chased away, Yehoshua is standing there on a mountaintop. And just as the other army is leaving leaving the Ai, Yehoshua raises his spear so that everybody can see. And the ambush that's waiting behind the city comes out of hiding, and they sweep in, and half of them go into the city to capture the city and burn it, and the other half marches to trap the army of the Ai in between the people they think they're chasing and the ones that are chasing them. So they turn around and they see their city's going up in smoke and there's an army coming behind them. They have nothing to go home to anymore. Their city is gone. So the battle, their spirit falls, they fall to pieces. And that's the capture of the Ai. Hashem tells him, I'm not going to make the walls fall down every place you go. You're going to have to figure out how to get past them. And that's the second second time you have a battle over here. Hashem is teaching Yehoshua a new strategy. Givon, now there's a long story over here with Givon that I'm not going to go into because we certainly don't have time to do that. But Givon, the way the story is told, it's told as a story of deception. The Givonim fool Yehoshua. When you take a look at the story very carefully, there's a real possibility that Yehoshua is the one deceiving them. That Yehoshua laid a trap for them and led them to believe that if they surrendered, that he would save them, which he really did save them, right? The city was spared. But somehow or another, it was Yehoshua who actually laid the foundations. They did not decide on their own to surrender. And it was Yehoshua who did that. Again, Givon is a walled city. How do you get past the walled city? Well, not brute force. Hashem took care of that with Jericho, but with the Ai, Yehoshua learned you have to sometimes be a little tricky. And then with Givon, he did the same thing. The battle of Givon, or the non-battle of Givon, right, the surrender of Givon, actually led to the fourth battle. And by the way, there are only five battles in this book, right? There's Yericho, Ai, Gibeon, the Southern Coalition, and the Northern Coalition. That's it, five battles, okay? In that fourth battle against the Southern Coalition, so there again, you had more than a dozen little city-states, each one of them surrounded by walls. How do you get past all of those walls? So what happened was, with the fall of Gibeon, they all left their cities unprotected. They brought their armies up to Gibeon in order to battle Gibeon to punish them for surrendering. So Yoshua, whoever was involved in this deception, what it actually ended up was that all of a sudden, instead of battling against dozens of fortified cities, Yoshua fights against armies out in the open where he has an advantage against them, because they're not used to fighting battles in the open. They're used to fighting from the protected area of their own city. Okay, I'm going to move a little bit quickly now. I'm looking at my slides and I'm about halfway done. And there's other stuff that's really essential in order to get a handle on Sefer Yoshua. So we spoke about one transition away from Moshe, a second transition away from miracles. There's a third transition, and that's a transition away from being dependent and from being nomads. Everything about their existence is changing. So first of all, the leadership. The leadership was a leadership of prophecy. Yoshua, even though he has prophecy at various points, but Yoshua is not really, his primary position is not the position of a Navi, of a prophet. He is really a political, military leader. If you take a look at the revelation that sort of inaugurates Yoshua into his position, the revelation that he has, he sees an angel, but he doesn't know it's an angel. He sees a figure that's dressed as a military commander. That's Yoshua's inauguration. Yoshua's job is to be a military leader. He is going to lead the conquest, okay? Which is a very different job than what Moshe did, right? And that's one of the ways that Yoshua steps into Moshe's shoes. He doesn't try to do what Moshe did. He tries to do what Moshe did not do. Okay, Moshe was not involved in the conquest, and Yoshua steps into those shoes. Yoshua was a military leader early on in the battle with Amalek, and that's what he carries over here. There's a lot of political, there's some, not a lot, but there are two instances of political intrigue in Sefer Yoshua, and again, they revolve around battles. One, I'll just allude to it quickly, is the challenge by Achan. Achan, as some of you may remember, is the one who stole from the spoils of Yericho, right? But what does he steal? Okay, so if you take a look at Pasuk Chaf Aleph in the top source, Va'era Bashalal, he says, I saw there in the spoils, Aderet Shinar Achat Tova. This is some kind of a very, very fancy cloak. That's the first thing he mentions. He saw this fancy cloak. What's Achan doing over here? My suspicion is that Achan is actually not stealing things because he likes them, but he's taking things from Yericho because he's planning to rebel against Yoshua. Remember that Achan is from Shevet Yehuda, and Yoshua is from Shevet Yosef. Yehuda feels slighted that they are not the leader over here. Knowing full well that the bracha they got from Yaakov is to be the leader. In Achan's case, he's doubly slighted because he's from the family of Yehuda that was passed over for the leadership. I suspect that what Achan is doing over here, he's gathering money and his royal cloak, preparing a challenge to Yoshua. The other one that is much more subtle than that, and that's actually a challenge by Kalev. Perek Yudalet tells us a strange story about Kalev sending a message to Yehoshua. And the message was, you know, I might be old, but I'm still as strong as I was 40 years ago. You know, when you and I came to conquer the land, There are places here in the land of Yehuda that you did not conquer properly. He doesn't say it that way, but it's very clear those are the implications. There are still giants in the land. Can I please have permission to conquer them? So this isn't a direct challenge to Yoshua, but there's something in there that that is a little bit threatening. So we have political military leadership. This is not prophetic leadership. And it's leadership not without its challenges. We move on and we get to, again, something similar. They're moving away. Again, it transitions away from being dependent nomads. We have Menashe and Ephraim. Menashe and Ephraim basically sit there and they tell Yoshua, the land that you gave us is not good because it has too many forests. Give us a different land. And Yeshua's answer in the last pasuk over here, in pasuk Yudchet, says, you have a mountain, Gihar Yelach, Ki Ya'arhu, it's a forest, well, very tall. So cut down the forest. You have to do the work. Okay, again, this is not the wilderness. We're not traveling in the Midbar. We don't have the Ananea Kavod accompanying us. We are here, we're settling the land. You can't be dependent on God for miracles. You have to take matters into your own hands and go do it. Just go do it. Cut down the forest. I'm going to skip over this these next two slides in order to be able to get to the second major theme, because all of this was in the realm of transitions. But there's a second major theme that runs throughout the Sefer that we need a few minutes to be able to address. Spoke a little bit about the fact that Yoshua finishes the job that Moshe did not. Okay, Moshe was supposed to, in the original plan, bring them through the Midbar, through the wilderness, and into the land. Moshe was stopped. Yoshua completes that. There's a cycle that's finished. This is the completion of the cycle of Brit Bin HaBetarim, the promise to Avraham in Breshit Perek Tedvav, where Hashem says, they're going to be strangers, but after 400 years, they're coming back. And finally, that's being fulfilled. So Sefer Yoshua is a fulfillment. In fact, there are some traditions that see Sefer Yoshua as the sixth book of the Torah, meaning not the beginning of Nevi'im. There are those who want to argue that there's a hexateuch, not a Pentateuch, and Sefer Yoshua is the sixth book because it really completes all that stuff that started in Sefer Bereishit and in Sefer Shmot. But it turns out that underneath all of that, there's actually something else going on that is much more profound. It's not just completing a cycle, but there's a major theological challenge that the beginning of Sefer Yoshua, that Sefer Yoshua has to deal with. Here's the challenge. I'll give you a mashal. You're going on a family trip, all right? And today it's really easy to imagine this. You plan this family trip. You've been looking forward to it for a long time. You get your family, you get to the airport, and then they announce that all flights are canceled. There's a lockdown on the pilots because they suspect the pilots have corona. And you're sitting there in the airport and you're waiting. They said, well, we'll let you know. We'll let you know when we can get the alternate pilots. And you're sitting there and you got your family there and you have your suitcases. You're all packed and you're waiting and you wait hours and hours and hours. And then they announce again, well, we think we might. And you end up spending 3 days in the airport, eating fruits and vegetables that you can buy, or candy bars. And then, after 3 days, the airport reopens, they have pilots, you go on your vacation, right? You have a serious challenge here. The serious challenge is, how do you vacation with these 3 days of bitterness and of terrible experiences behind you? In the case of Am Yisrael, it's compounded much more. When Moshe comes to Bnei Yisrael in Mitzrayim, he tells them, God's taking you out of this land and he's taking you to Eretz Yisrael. And he didn't. That's a serious theological problem. You can blame it on whatever you want to blame it. But the bottom line is it didn't happen. And for 40 years, they're wandering in the Midbar. And an entire generation dies out. How do you erase those 40 years? How do you go into Eretz Yisrael and sort of try to make believe that, or some, or do something with, compensate for the fact that Hashem promised and he fulfilled the first half of the promise, but not the second half. And the second half is delayed, so the people who got the first half didn't get the second, and vice versa. So it turns out, if you take a look at the beginning of Sefer Yehoshua, there are a number of really interesting things that happen, especially in the first few chapters. First of all, we have I didn't bring all the sources over here, but you can find it very easily. When the spies come, there are two spies that Yehoshua sends to Yericho, and they come to Rahav, and Rahav takes care of them, and she hides them, and she protects them. And the language that she uses, I'm just going to read to you one pasuk. This is Perek Beit, Pasuk Tet. The language that she uses to explain why she's being good to them, she says, V'chi nafla ematchem aleinu. Your terror has fallen over us. V'chi namogu kol yoshvei ha'aretz mipneichem. That all the inhabitants of the land are melting. This is language that's lifted directly from Shirat Hayam. Sefer Yehoshua is trying to present, not only to those people, but to us, the readers, is trying to present a bridge. It's a bridge that connects Yitziat Mitzrayim with the entry into the land. So what Rahav does, what she provides for us, and it comes up again later, what she provides for us is the language that says, oh, you mean like Yitziat Mitzrayim like last week? Right? That language serves as a powerful bridge. We mentioned beforehand, we spoke about the stopping of the Jordan. The stopping of the Jordan is meant not only to raise the status of Yehoshua in the eyes of the people to the level of Moshe, but it's also meant to serve as a bridge. You went from Kriyat Yamsuf, and now you're going to the stopping of the Jordan. It's meant to form a mental bridge that links the leaving of Egypt with the entry into Eretz Yisrael. Then you have the whole story of the Pesach. They left Mitzrayim at the Pesach, and the first thing that they, that was the last thing they did in Egypt, and the first thing they do when they get to Eretz Yisrael is they do the Pesach. So there's a conceptual bridge over here that the Navi is trying to make. And the last one I'll mention in this context is Rahav. When Rahav makes a deal with these two spies, so they tell her, well, we'll save you. Right. Well, the Yericho is going to be destroyed, but you and your family will be saved under two conditions. Number one, you have to stay in your house, and number two, you have to hang a red thread from the from your window so that we can identify you. When I hear that, the first thing that comes to mind is the night that they left Mitzrayim. There was a red mark on every Jewish house. And anybody who left that house was not protected. So here we have the opening five chapters of Sefer Yehoshua are trying to bridge those 40 years. I can say erase those 40 years. You can say bridge those 40 years. It's trying to connect Yitziat Mitzrayim with the entry into Eretz Yisrael so that God's promise is being fulfilled. Okay, there's a completion that's taking place over here. I'd like to focus on one other completion, and then I'm going to stop. We lost 3 minutes at the beginning, so I'm taking three extra minutes now, and then we'll open up to questions. Here's the other piece that, in terms of completions, that really is a central focus, particularly in the first 10 chapters of Sefer Yehoshua. The 40 years, and it's connected back to this whole issue with the 40 years. Why were Bnei Yisrael in the Midbar for 40 years? Because of the story of the Meraglim, right? That's what it's called. That's what we'll refer to it. That was what changed God's promise from leaving Mitzrayim, entering Eretz Yisrael, to that huge delay in the middle. What Yehoshua needs to do, he needs either to undo that, which is one way of saying it, or do a tikkun for that story of the Meraglim, remembering, of course, that Yehoshua was one of them, and the other one was Kalev, right, in that story there. When those 12 men came back from their tour, they reported that the land was wonderful. But there were two main problems, right? Problems that in their eyes were insurmountable. There were walls and there were giants. We can't overcome those walls. They're up to the heavens. We can't overcome the giants. We feel like grasshoppers in front of them. The battles, every battle in the first 10 chapters, every one of those five battles involves overcoming either the challenge of the walls. Actually, everyone involves challenge of getting around the walls. We mentioned Jericho, the Ai, ambush, Gibeon, surrender. The Battle of the South is you draw them out of their cities. And similarly, the Battle of the North, they were drawn out of their cities as they came in this coalition. The walls are central. That was what Bnei Yisrael were afraid of. That's what Yehoshua learns to compensate for. That's what Hashem helps him with in the beginning. And then Yehoshua learns to compensate for that. That's a major theme in the conquest of Eretz Yisrael. The other theme, which is not as major, but is very prominent, it appears at the end of the battles. It appears with Kalev as well. And that's the theme of the giants. How do we overcome the giants? Kalev says, I'll take care of the giants. Don't worry. And in doing that, what Yehoshua the person and what Yehoshua the book are trying to do is they are trying to undo the sin of the Meraglim, right? Yehoshua sends spies also, right? But he sends them completely differently than Moshe. He sends two, not 12. He sends them anonymous people, not famous people. He sends them on a spying mission, an overt spying mission, not something else, right? Yehoshua understands, as a military person, he understands what a spying mission needs to be. So a huge piece of the opening of Sefer Yehoshua is meant really to somehow or another do a tikkun, if you want to use that language, or to undo the problem, if you want to use that language, of the story of the Meraglim. I'm just going to take 1 minute to summarize. We said we're going to deal today, Sefer Yehoshua is a book of transitions and completions. So in transitions, we spoke about, first of all, the transitions away from Moshe. How do you fill those shoes? Second was transition away from miracles. And there we spoke about the military tactics, the move from miraculous to in terms of food. And then we spoke also about the transition away from dependency into, which is connected, dependency into independence. At the end, we spoke about two other themes that fall under the completion, right? Completions and tikkun. One of them was erasing the 40 years and all of those images of the entry into Eretz Yisrael as a mirror image of the last days in Mitzrayim and the first days out of Mitzrayim. And then we have the undoing of the story of the Meraglim, which is directly connected also to erasing of those 40 years. Okay, I'm going to stop. Stop sharing.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. You want to take a look at the questions? Well, thank you. And I'm glad we sorted out, I think, the issues that most of you have got on. Thank you. And a pleasure to we'll continue Monday morning in this series while you look at the questions with Rebecca Winter on Sefer Shoftim. I'll be giving my regular Pirkei Avot here tomorrow morning, 9:30 a.m. Everybody is welcome. And Rabbi Tzvi, if you want to take some of the questions, Vakasha.
Okay.
And while I'll do that, I'll give people the ability to unmute themselves if you'd like to. After, then you can personally talk. Okay. Now you have to unmute yourself, Tzvi. I'm sorry.
Okay, I'm scrolling through the chat over here.
Yes. The question is, okay, one question, if you didn't see them, why didn't they conquer the whole land and drive out the inhabitants, like it appears to say in the Chumash?
So that's a great question. It's such a good question that I think that that is the opening question of Sefer Shoftim. I'll tell Rebecca.
She has to speak about that. Okay.
Okay. But Sefer Yoshua leaves us with the impression. I mean, you read Sefer Yoshua, it sounds like the language in a number of places sounds like they finished the job. Right. I'll read to you one very short passage over here. The end of Perek Kaf Aleph. Vayitain Hashem liYisrael et kol haaretz asher nishba latet laavotam. Vayirashu avayishvu ba. God gave them the entire land. Vayanach Hashem lahem misaviv kechol asher nishba laavotam. Hashem did everything for them as He promised. Lo amad ish bifnehem mikol oyvehem. Lo nafal davar mikol hatov asher diber Hashem el beit Yisrael hakol ba. So Yoshua leaves us with the impression that everything worked perfectly. Sefer Shoftim opens with the critique of that. It wasn't so perfect. Okay? I'll share with you one other thought about this, and that is that, and this I heard many years ago, I believe from Rav Yoel Ben Nun, in which he distinguishes between conquering the land and settling the land. And what I mean is like this. When you conquer the land, you basically get rid of the military resistance. And that's what Sefer Yoshua is all about. It's all about getting rid of the military resistance. But the people are still living there. That's something they did not do. Okay? And that is very, the Perek Aleph of Sefer Shoftim. I mean, that is the main thrust. It tells you just how much they didn't do. That's due to a number of reasons. One of them is the fact that after the battles were over, Yoshua made a decision, and his decision was that the best way to settle the land is to actually settle the land, not to continue the battles, but to actually settle people in. So there's a pasuk that speaks about Yoshua sending the people home. Go home. Build your homes. You can't be in a military campaign forever. You have to start your lives again. It reminds me a little bit of the times that we're in now, right? You have to, at some point, you have to restart your lives. And that was the decision that Yoshua makes. In Sefer Yoshua, you don't see the impact of that. But in the very, very first perek of Sefer Shoftim, that hits us right in the face.
Very quickly, I guess I find an interesting question. Does Rachav's red thread combine to Ptil Techelet that follows the Chet Hamaraglim? Do you see any connection? The red and blue.
That's interesting. I never thought of that. And it's something I need to think about. Okay. It's a very interesting idea, and I need to sort of process that and figure out what to do with that.
And somebody, very good. And somebody just asked, you sort of alluded to now a little bit, but what is the second half of the Sefer, sort of the dividing of the land to the tribes, what sort of main message you want to put there in the Al Regel Achad?
So here, that was part of what I skipped. I'm going to go back to sharing, and I'll just show this to you very briefly. If you take a look at this slide that's coming up now, you'll see that part of the way the land was settled, and there are a few things here. Number one, the division of the land is broken up into basically three waves. The first wave happened during Moshe's time. Moshe gave Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi Shevet Menashe, half of Shevet Menashe. He gave them the eastern bank of the Jordan, as you see here. Yoshua does the second wave. The second wave involves Menashe, Ephraim, Yehuda. Okay, another way of saying Yosef. Menashe, Ephraim is Yosef and Yehuda. And when you put those two together, you're talking about the overwhelming majority of the land. Those were the main figures in the story of Yosef. These are the main leaders, all the way back. And they're going to remain the main leaders for the rest of the history of Tanakh. And in between Yosef and Yehuda is sandwiched little Benjamin. Right? Meaning there's tension over where Benjamin belongs. So that, for example, during the times of Shaul, so Binyamin clearly belongs with the northern tribes. During the time of David, Binyamin actually allies themselves more with Yehuda. Okay? So there's this tension over them. Where does everybody else go? So everybody, you have the other children of Leah, basically in a circle, in the immediate circle around Yosef, Binyamin, and Yehuda. So you've got Shimon in the south, you've got Yisachar and Zvulun in the north. And then you want to get to the Bnei HaShfachot, right? The children of the maidservants. So you've got Dan, Asher, Naphtali in the far north, like up in Lebanon, but really, really, really far north. And Gad way out in the east, and that was their choice when they chose to go to the east. So those middle prakim that talk about the division, so one of the things that really emerges from all of that is, again, preferential treatment for Yosef and Yehuda, the leadership tribes, and secondary status for the other children of Leah, and tertiary status, third level status for the Bnei HaShfachot stuck way out in the boondocks. Okay, and again, that is much of what happens in those middle chapters.
Okay, thank you very much. I think that's it's 12:15. We'll let people go, and really a pleasure to a wonderful overview of Sefer Yeshua that I haven't looked at so recently. So really much appreciated, and I think many people appreciate it. We look forward to seeing you further learning, and with everybody back, like I say, Monday morning, tomorrow if you want to come, other shiurim we have, and everybody be well, be safe, and have a wonderful day. Okay, have a great day, everybody. Yes,
I'll also just say I didn't get a chance to look through all the questions and all the chats, but if there are questions here that you want to send my way with emails, I'll be happy to respond to people.
Yeah. And of course, the slideshow will go on. The slide will go on the Torah Motion website, as is the recording. If you've missed any of the past first five shiurim, you can listen to them. They're all been wonderful, all different. It's really, if I can say, we're very proud of the program. And, it's the attendance has been wonderful. And I think the quality of the speakers has been outstanding. And we look forward.